This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Newslink.
Hello, welcome to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the program, we'll hear all about this year's three winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, all women from developing nations. And on a day of downgrades, we'll hear how Britain's government rushed to the defense of their banking system.
British banks are well capitalized, they are liquid, they are not experiencing the kinds of problems that some of the banks in the Eurozone are experiencing at the moment.
We'll also hear how Bollywood movies are sweeping the Czech Republic? Really? Yeah, really. We'll bring you those stories and much, much more coming up on Newslink. On Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. This year's Nobel Peace Prize celebrates women's work for peace and human rights. It was awarded in Oslo earlier on Friday to Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, her peace campaigning countrywoman, Lema Glaoubi, and Yemeni human rights activist, Tavakkul Karman. Our correspondent Lars Bavanger has been in the Norwegian capital for Nobel Week, and he sent us this report.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2011 is to be divided in three equal parts between Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Lema Glaoubi, and Tavakkul Karman.
A bit of a mouthful for the Norwegian Nobel Committee chairman, Torbjørn Jagland, but this year's three winners have been welcomed by many countries around the world. After last year's decision to award the prize to Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo drew fierce criticism from Beijing, rewarding women involved in the non-violent struggle for peace and democracy has proved far less controversial.
We still haven't come to grips with our past, you know. A past that is a mix of being an indigenous African country.
President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, here speaking earlier to Al Jazeera Television, won global recognition as Africa's first female elected head of state in 2005 and has been credited with stabilizing Liberia after 14 years of civil conflict. Her co-laureate, Lema Glaoubi, was central to the peace talks, which led to the end of Liberia's second civil war in 2003. People clashing with government forces in the Yemeni capital Sana'a earlier this year. The third Nobel Peace Prize winner, Tavakkul Karman, rose to prominence co-organizing rallies to protest against President Ali Abdullah Saleh and his government. Including her in this year's award was very important, says Nobel watcher Sverre Lodgaard from the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs.
Had it only been for the two women from Liberia, the message would have been a message about Liberia and Africa. Enter Tavakkul Karman from Yemen. And there is a prize also for a participant in the Arab Spring. And then the committee emphasizes Security Council Resolution 1325 on women's rights and the fight for democracy, for universal values. And all of this amounts to a global message.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has said in the past it does not only award people for past peace work, but wants to inspire them to continue in their efforts. In the case of Karman and Yemen, the struggle is clearly not over. But Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is in a different situation. She is running for re-election in Liberia's presidential elections on Tuesday, prompting some to question whether awarding her the Peace Prize right now might influence her chances at the polls. Yet that was a notion dismissed by the committee chairman, Torbjørn Jagland, soon after his announcement.
The committee has time and again demonstrated that we do not look to domestic politics. We do only look at those persons who have done most for peace in the world, according to Alfred Nobel's will. We cannot say that because one is facing elections in Liberia, we shouldn't choose Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. We only have to look at what she has been doing for peace in Liberia and also in West Africa.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee's choice this year has highlighted not only the plight of women in wars, but also their crucial contribution to end wars. It also sends a clear message to the Yemeni president that it is time for him to step down. All three winners are expected to come here to Oslo City Hall to a ceremony in December where they'll receive one Nobel medal each, but they'll have to share the 1.1 million euro prize money. Lars Bevanger, Deutsche Welle Radio, Oslo.
You're listening to Deutsche Welle.
The ratings agency Moody's has downgraded 12 British financial institutions, including several major banks. It explained the move by saying the UK government was now less likely to step in and bail them out than it was during the financial crisis of 2008. From London, Ali Barrett reports.
To market watchers, the downgrade of 12 financial firms was no great surprise. But at a time of financial crisis in the Eurozone and doubts about the global economy, market strategist at IG Index David Jones says the move was always going to cause jitters.
News like this, particularly at the moment, always unnerves markets a little bit. So that's why we're seeing most of these banks' prices a little bit weaker today in London.
But there is a positive spin to put on the downgrade.
Moody's have changed their position because 3 years ago we had the bank bailouts. Now if they got into trouble, it's suggesting that sort of a help isn't going to be there. But I suppose the positive way of looking at it is the fact that actually the UK government now views these banks as being much more robust than they were a few years ago, so don't feel the need to have to step in again at some point in the future.
Among the firms downgraded, Lloyds, TSB and RBS both bailed out in 2008 and still partly owned by the British taxpayer. Building Society Nationwide saw its rating cut too, as did the UK arm of Spanish bank Santander. UK Chancellor George Osborne told the BBC it's correct of Moody's to believe future bailouts are less likely.
People ask me, you know, how are you going to avoid Britain and the British taxpayer bailing out banks in the future? This government is taking steps to do that, and therefore credit rating agencies and others will say, well, actually, these banks have got to show that they can pay their way in the world. And I'm confident that British banks are well capitalised, they are liquid, they are not experiencing the kinds of problems that some of the banks in the Eurozone are experiencing at the moment.
But the news did come with a crisis in the Eurozone destabilising the European banking sector and with economic growth flatlining in Britain. And a day after the Bank of England announced a new round of quantitative easing, essentially printing money. The hope is that QE will make borrowing easier and cheaper for British banks like those downgraded by Moody's. It is a gamble, though, and could cause inflation and a further weakening of the economy. So British banks and the British economy remain in uncharted territory. Ollie Barrett, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
In Spain and in Italy, too, they've got their own downgrades to worry about. Ratings agency Fitch cut their assessment of both countries' sovereign debt Friday evening, citing the Eurozone crisis, poor economic growth, and lack of fiscal discipline. And for Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, it just made a bad day worse. He's already renowned for his propensity for gaffes and offensive statements, and he's in hot water for a vulgar comment that he made in Parliament. Other off-color remarks have been unearthed in wiretapped conversations. As Megan Williams reports from Rome, Berlusconi has been trying to stop their publication.
It's difficult to report on the slew of vulgarity caught on tape, TV, and in Parliament that's come out of the mouth of Prime Minister Berlusconi without sounding like a potty mouth yourself. His latest off-color joke made in Parliament was that he'd like to change the name of his party from People of Freedom to Go Pussy. And no, it doesn't reflect his love of kittens. It's hardly a standalone gaffe, either by the ever more unpopular leader or his coalition members. On the same day, members of the Northern League, the party whose support is keeping Berlusconi in power, rudely insulted Member of Parliament Lucia Codarelli when she criticized their policies. This morning, after I aired my frustration with their support of Berlusconi's policies, a member of the Northern League turned to me and told me to go get screwed. Codarelli and others say the comments, both Berlusconi's and the Northern League's, merely reflect the deeply sexist and hostile attitude toward women held by those in power in Italy. In the last weeks alone, Italian papers have published the transcripts of wiretapped phone calls made by investigators. Berlusconi has reportedly crassly described the size of German leader Angela Merkel's derriere, bragged about how many young women he bedded in one night, 8, and even confirmed many Italians' growing suspicion by boasting that he was only prime minister part-time. Evidence suggests that the other half of his time he's been hiring young prostitutes or fighting legal battles to keep himself out of prison. But not just legal battles. Berlusconi is now trying to introduce a gag law that would stop the publication of wiretapped conversations, the ones that have been so embarrassing to him. The proposals would oblige websites to change content within 48 hours of people or organizations they mentioned complained of errors or defamation.
Ricordatevelo, questa battaglia non è solo di voi giornalisti, è nostra, della società italiana.
There have been weekly marches in Rome against the proposed law by journalists, and Wikipedia Italia has gone offline in protest. Even original supporters, such as center-right MP Giulia Bongiorno, has disowned the law. That was after Berlusconi's party added an amendment that would see journalists jailed for between 6 months and 3 years if they published wiretaps deemed irrelevant.
Improvvisamente, negli ultimi giorni, ho sentito una serie di proposte di una sorta di marcia.
This law was supposed to protect freedom of expression and at the same time defendants' rights. And to see it changed this way, I no longer back it. Bongiorno later added that the proposed law had nothing to do with protecting ordinary Italians. And opposition members say it has everything to do with helping Berlusconi. The law goes before Parliament next week. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
Madeira. You might know it as a fortified wine. You might know it as an exotic vacation destination. You might not know it at all. Okay, I'll tell you. It's a set of small islands a ways off the coast of Morocco, which are an autonomous region of Portugal. It's an out-of-the-way kind of place that doesn't get very much attention. But its regional elections, to be held this weekend, have suddenly shot into the headlines. That's because Portugal and the EU have had a look over Madeira's finances and found that it is in debt to the tune of about 6 billion euros. I asked our correspondent in Portugal, Alison Roberts, how this all happened.
It's an autonomous region. Portugal has two of those, the mid-Atlantic Azores Islands and Madeira. Both of these regions, as you say, they're pretty remote, and they've both won generous subsidies from both the central government and from the European Union over the years, thanks to their remoteness and relative poverty. And over the past couple of decades, they've leveraged that, they've used that to borrow also on their own account. In the case of Madeira, it's emerged that the regional government now has debts of more than 6 billion euros, and that's equivalent to well over the region's GDP, in fact about 125%. And the unexpectedly huge scale of that debt is, according to both national Portuguese and international officials, enough to knock the whole country off course as it struggles, of course, to implement the bailout plan that was sponsored by the EU and International Monetary Fund.
Well, how did Madeira rack up this big debt, and how did they hide it for as long as they did?
Madeira has been investing a lot in infrastructure, and there are other projects that we're engaged in. And of course, the regional government was very keen to take the credit for those large projects. And of course, that has helped over the years Madeira's premier, Alberto João Jardim, to stay in power for all of 30 plus years. So he's probably one of the longest serving political leaders in Europe. So he, to an extent, did have an incentive to keep that money coming and to keep borrowing on the basis of those European funds. The fact that Madeira is an autonomous region means that it can hide, if you like, or rather it has power over its own accounts. So exactly how it's managed to hide it, if you like, it's not quite clear, and the central government and the regional government acknowledge they're going to have to do something about.
Now, you mentioned this premier, Alberto João Jardim. What do voters in Madeira think about this debt? Are they going to punish him, or is he in any danger of losing power come this weekend?
Clearly, he's been tremendously popular over the years to be in power that long. There are elections this Sunday, until quite recently the polls were pointing to his being able to get another outright majority. Now they're looking a little more dodgy. It's looking less clear that he will be able to get an outright majority. The opposition, of course, have been criticising him very, very fiercely for this, but he does pick up quite a few votes on the basis that he is defending Madeira from the imperial tendencies, if you like, of Portugal. He likes to say that Portugal would like Madeira to be a colony and that they need to retain a certain amount of independence. But there certainly are people locally that are worried about the future, and it does seem likely that locals are going to face cuts. And it now seems that there's going to be a special adjustment plan for Madeira, which may mean more pain for those people in that region.
Alison Roberts in Lisbon. From Bonn, Germany, in the heart of Europe, you're listening to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herman. 5 years ago, the prominent Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya was gunned down in the elevator of her apartment building in the center of Moscow. Since then, suspects have been arrested, but as yet, none convicted, and the identity of those who ordered the killing remains unknown. Politkovskaya was best known for her critical reports about the war in Chechnya, where she exposed numerous crimes committed by Russian troops against the civilian population. Gerhard Korkamp reports.
On the fifth anniversary of her death, relatives and colleagues of Anna Politkovskaya had chosen to refrain from the usual street demonstrations as a way of commemorating her. Still, they and many other people came and went throughout the day to Politkovskaya's home in the center of Moscow, where she was gunned down in October 2006. Among those who laid flowers next to the door through which Politkovskaya and her killer passed 5 years ago was the editor-in-chief of Politkovskaya's newspaper Novaya Gazeta, Dmitry Muratov. He expressed optimism over the investigation into her death. The hired killer who entered the building 5 years ago has been arrested in Chechnya, he said. One of the organizers of the crime, Colonel Pavlyuchenkov, has been arrested. The investigation is progressing, and the factory where the murder weapon was prepared has been identified. So I think that lately the investigation and the newspaper have been successful. Muratov and others remembered Politkovskaya later in the day in the newspaper's office and watched a preview of a new documentary about her in the Moscow House of Journalists.
Мы начинаем наш выпуск с трагического сообщения из Москвы. 2.5 часа назад в собственном подъезде убита журналистка Анна Политковская.
The film, made by veteran documentary director Marina Goldovskaya, shows rare footage of Politkovskaya shot during the last 30 years of her life and will be shown to the public in Moscow in November.
Ко мне в одном селе подходит женщина.
Three suspected accomplices in the murder of Politkovskaya were acquitted in 2009 when a jury decided that their guilt had not been proven. The Supreme Court revoked the court's decision and ruled that the investigation be continued. This year, the suspected killer has been arrested, as well as several suspected accomplices. On Friday, one of them was officially accused of involvement in the killing of Politkovskaya, as a spokesman for the prosecutor's office, Vladimir Markin, told Russian television on a visit to Germany.
Сегодня Ломаре Гайтукаеву предъявлено обвинение в убийстве Анны Политковской.
Today, he said, Lom Ali Gatukaev has been accused of killing Anna Politkovskaya for her professional activity as a member of a hired criminal gang. Sergei Khachikurbanov will soon be accused of the same. These two men, together with former police officer Dmitry Pavlyuchenkov, are being accused of having organized the killing. Pavlyuchenkov is said to have been paid money for the organization by an as yet unknown person. The key question remains who was behind it all and ordered the assassination of Politkovskaya. Her colleagues and relatives fear that this part of the story may never be known, especially if it turns out that the evidence points towards the involvement of some high officials. According to Novaya Gazeta's editor-in-chief, Dmitry Muratov, finding the initiator should be possible if, he said, the will to do so is there. Gerhard Kurkamp, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
bring you perspectives on the news from a uniquely European point of view. You're tuned into Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio from Bonn, Germany. A piece from the unlikely cross-cultural exchange department now. The Prague Indian Film Festival has just got underway in the Czech capital, offering the best that contemporary Indian cinema has to offer, from Bollywood blockbusters to serious documentaries on contemporary Indian society. Started 9 years ago by a group of Bollywood enthusiasts, it's grown from a small student festival to a mainstream event, drawing several thousand people each year. Rob Cameron sent this report from Prague.
A trailer for the 2010 Bollywood film I Hate Love Stories, which opened this year's festival at Prague's Svetozor Cinema. The film is a very postmodern take on Indian film. It's a Bollywood movie about Bollywood movies, the story of a young Bollywood set designer who finds herself falling in love with an equally young assistant director who hates the schmaltz of the films he helps to produce, but eventually finds himself in his own love story. Perhaps it shouldn't even be called a Bollywood film at all. It is just a film made in India about Bollywood, albeit with a bit of singing and dancing. Indeed, the Prague Indian Film Festival has followed Bollywood's coming of age, something reflected in the fact that even the title has changed from the Bollywood Film Festival to the Indian Film Festival. The festival's co-founder and creative director, Radim Spacek, explains.
Usually we didn't show only Bollywood movies. We are trying to show also documentaries and Tamil or Marathi movies or some serious artistic films. It's very difficult to deal with those genre different filmmakers if you call yourself as a Bollywood film festival. So that's more kind of sign to India that we are not only Bollywood showcase, that we show all other genres or all other films.
The Indian Film Festival now attracts around 4,000 cinema goers each year, choosing between 20 feature films and 15 documentaries, dealing with everything from the killing of Osama bin Laden to life in Kashmir. Many film fans, however, come for the traditional Bollywood extravaganzas, where the plots can be just slightly predictable and the stars have a tendency to break out into song about every 10 minutes. So can cynical Western audiences really appreciate Bollywood film without sneering? Radim Spacek again.
I mean, maybe not appreciate so much as favorite, for example, Hollywood movies, but could be a little bit weird for somebody. But anyway, the Bollywood is changing, and for me as a filmmaker, is very unique to see the changes in time and in the row of 10 years. How really the films are more perfect, how different new themes are coming, and of course for people who like. Who like India, that's kind of like, that's a piece of India, you know, and memories of India, you know, and for 3 hours. It's a short trip to India, you know, to go to a Bollywood movie and cinema.
Next year, we'll see the festival celebrate its 10th anniversary. Certainly, Radim and his co-founders could never have envisaged that when they started back in 2003. The festival reflects a growing appetite for Czechs for all things exotic. There's even an Indian food festival that's run by the same group of India devotees. Rob Cameron, Deutsche Welle Radio, Prague.
For more news and information from the heart of Europe, visit our website, dwworld.de. There you'll find the latest news updates as well as podcasts of many Deutsche Welle radio programs. With a uniquely European perspective on the events of the day, you're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink from Bonn, Germany. My name is Matt Herman. You're listening to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Matt Herman. Coming up on the next 30 minutes of Newslink, Germany and Poland are friends and neighbors these days, but that didn't stop Poland's right-wing opposition leader from launching a tirade against Angela Merkel.
We still have people who believe that we are still under the danger of Germans who want to have their territories back or something like that. And Kaczynski is a master in constructing things which we should be afraid of.
We'll have that story in a few minutes, but first, as of this Friday, NATO's mission in Afghanistan is 10 years old. The alliance's Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, said he believed that the Afghan security forces were improving rapidly and that the alliance was still on track to be out by 2014. But such a long mission is bound to have had a permanent impact on NATO. I asked one of Germany's leading security analysts, Heinz Schulte, what it had been.
Well, first of all, remember, let us go back 10 years ago. It was the first time that NATO invoked Article 5. Article 5 means that you help each other in case of an attack. And the curious thing was that NATO invoked Article 5 in order to aid the United States. And I think, again, it is against that background that you have to see the NATO operation in Afghanistan. Afghanistan became a NATO operation, as opposed to Iraq, which was an American operation associated with its allies. So from that point of view, you could see that the solidarity over Afghanistan was much more coherent in the NATO context than it was over Iraq.
There was the sense in the earlier years of the operation in Afghanistan that German troops were going to concentrate on rebuilding and perhaps training roles. In the last couple of years, German troops have become ever more targets of attacks by Taliban insurgents and have had a more active combat role. How is that going to change both the public's view of the German armed forces and perhaps the patience of the Bundeswehr to stay in Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. The idea was that the Germans were invited to take over the northern part of Afghanistan, which at that time was more quiet. And when the Germans started very successfully with the Allies who were in that part, the Norwegians and the Danes and others, to really build up the infrastructure, build schools for girls and all the rest of it, it was then that it attracted the attention of the Taliban, who of course didn't like that bit, and all of a sudden a stabilizing operation became a combat operation, and that did change the mandate for the German armed forces. Now, as far as your second point is concerned, the Germans said, we will leave Afghanistan only in concert with our allies. There will be no premature withdrawal unilaterally. And therefore, the Germans will withdraw or reduce together with the United States and the other partners. And it is against that background that the German government tries to persuade the German public, which is losing patience, to hang in there. And I think that now that a withdrawal date has been suggested, that there is consensus that the Germans should stay the course.
Now, in NATO's most recent operation in Libya, Germany was a very public abstainer from that operation. Is that in some ways, can we interpret that as the German government's way of telling its people who perhaps are not that keen on further military interventions that we are sticking with Afghanistan, but we will go no further?
Well, I think this has to be seen case by case. Libya was a special case, and I think that the Germans misread the situation. They misread it because they really felt that an abstention didn't hurt German solidarity. It did, because an abstention from your friends is something different in the case of Germany than an abstention by Russia and by China, which really literally means you can go ahead, but we will not join you. So from that point of view, I wouldn't see a connect between the two. Afghanistan was a clear mandate. Libya, I think that the Germans were surprised by the backlash, and if there had to be a Libya resolution again, I'm not quite sure that the Germans would take the same stance as they did.
Security analyst Heinz Schulte. Around around the world, around the clock. News and information from the heart of Europe on DWTV, Deutsche Welle Radio, and online too at dwworld.de. This is Newslink. I'm your host, Matt Herman. The people of Poland are voting in a general election this Sunday. Prime Minister Donald Tusk from the Civic Platform Party is seeking another term in office. He's fighting off a challenge from Jarosław Kaczyński, head of the Nationalist Law and Justice Party. Kaczyński is never one known for too much subtlety, and he recently made a number of anti-German remarks about Chancellor Angela Merkel that were so far-reaching that five former Polish foreign ministers, among others, immediately leapt to her defense and asked him to tone it down. Hardy Grabner reports.
Partly in a pre-election interview for the Polish edition of Newsweek, and partly in his new book called The Poland of Our Dreams, Jarosław Kaczyński attacked Germany for not taking Poland's concerns seriously enough. Among other things, he said that German Chancellor Angela Merkel represented the generation of politicians in Berlin who wanted to rebuild German imperial power. He spoke of Berlin's strategic axis with Moscow, to which Poland could only be an obstacle. Kaczyński also suggested that Poles might one day wake up in a smaller home country, alluding that Germans might want to have back the parts of Poland they lost after World War II. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk was among the first to react to what he thought were remarks with a strong potential to damage relations with Germany. Mr. Kaczyński is looking to boost voter support with all conceivable methods, among them methods which I clearly disapprove of, he said. We've known him as a political cowboy. He hates the Russians, and yes, he's not particularly in love with the Germans either. Marcin Poprawski lectures at Adam Mickiewicz University in the western Polish town of Poznan. He says Mr. Kaczyński's verbal attacks against German leaders have a long history. With him as prime minister, German-Polish relations experienced a rough ride. According to Poprawski, Donald Tusk has done a good job in taking bilateral relations to a new level in the past couple of years.
I think Polish-German relations at the time of Donald Tusk's government were strongly improved. He is a very good and sensitive politician who understands the complexity and the historical context of relations. While Kaczyński, his advisors and he personally, I think they don't understand it properly. They just play the German card shortly before elections for inexperienced people who have nothing to do with Germans on a daily basis.
German political analyst and former ambassador to Poland, Michael Gertz, feels Germans should not expect all Poles to develop a perfect relationship with Germans after centuries of bitterness between the two nations, above all after Hitler Germany's invasion of Poland in 1939. Old wounds need some more time to heal, Gertz says.
We still, as Germans, have to be very careful and sensitive and develop enough understanding for our Polish friends that they will not forget history.
There's no denying that some people, particularly those far away from the German border and hence without much contact with Germans, could still be swayed into believing that German politicians were working towards getting back lost territories, says Marcin Poprawski.
We still have people who believe that we are still under the danger of Germans who want to have their territories back or something like that. And Kaczyński is a master in constructing things which we should be afraid of.
But ordinary Poles living in the border region are unlikely to buy Mr. Kaczyński's arguments about Germany trying to become an empire again and trying to subjugate its eastern neighbor step by step.
No, I don't feel this at all. I can't imagine that people in Poland actually are afraid of Germany. I can't imagine that there are so many. I mean, maybe people from the village, because they don't reflect, they don't analyze.
I'm not afraid of this neighbor. German is our friends now. This isn't a Second World War, so this is only stereotypes.
Hardy Graupner, Deutsche Welle Radio.
To soccer now, and another story of Germany's relations with a key neighbor. Not a next-door neighbor, one right in the household. You'll see what I mean. Germany have already qualified for the European Championships in 2012, but there was plenty of tension in the lead-up to their qualifier against Turkey on Friday. Matches between the two are often highly charged affairs because Germany has such a large Turkish migrant community. Indeed, nearly 5% of residents here are either Turkish citizens or have roots in Turkey. Players eligible to play for both countries face some tough choices about where their loyalties lie. Some Turkish fans can be unforgiving if they feel a player has opted for the wrong side. And Turkey's recruitment drive in Germany for young German players of Turkish descent is beginning to cause friction. Uwe Hessler reports.
About a year ago, Germany midfielder Mesut Özil scored the second goal in Germany's convincing 3-0 victory over Turkey. The German fans in a packed Olympic stadium in Berlin gave the son of Turkish immigrants standing ovations while he was booed and jeered by the Turkish fans, most of whom came from Germany. In the Turkish-dominated Berlin district of Kreuzberg, fans used more pointed language to describe their compatriot's performance. This Turkish fan calls Özil a traitor, who isn't the son of a Turkish mother, but of someone less respectable. And another Turkish fan says that Mesut Özil is no longer and probably has never been a real Turk.
Das ist kein originaler Türke.
In 2007, Mesut Özil decided to play for Germany, saying he feels like a German. Turkish football officials have been fuming ever since and recently intensified attempts to convince young players of Turkish origin brought up in Germany to pledge their allegiance to the red shirt of Turkey. Erdal Keser is a talent scout for the Turkish Football Association. We want to assess the players, he says, and if they are good enough to play international football, then we want to give them that opportunity. Just last week, Ömer Toprak, a member of the German under-19 team, which won the 2008 European Championship, said he would play for Turkey in future. He now joins Mehmet Ekici, an under-21 European champion for Germany, as well as another three Germany-born players in the current Turkish squad. German team manager Oliver Bierhoff is rather critical of the Turkish campaign. We clearly reject such behavior, but don't want to join this race for young players, he says. I think the two football associations should display greater responsibility in recruiting young players. According to newspaper reports, the Turkish association is also said to be after a number of Turkish players in the current under-17 team of Germany, which finished in third place in the World Cup this summer. That is why Matthias Sammer, the German Football Federation's sporting director, said he wanted to step up efforts to cultivate a greater German identity in the junior teams, a move supported by national coach Joachim Löw. We are of course talking with those players, he says, but are always telling them that it's a decision of heart they have to make for themselves. We are definitely not exerting any pressure on them. However, in the race for the best Turkish football talents here, Germany's behavior doesn't appear to be above board either. Coach Joachim Löw is planning to include İlkay Gündoğan in his lineup for next week's match against Belgium. Gündoğan isn't among Germany's top players yet, but a first cap for this country's national team would mean he would never be able to play for Turkey under international rules. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Information and perspectives from a European point of view. Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herman. The French rail service asked passengers on Friday to simply organize their own transport, as employees stopped work across the country after a ticket taker was stabbed while going about his rounds. John Lawrenson reports from Paris about a new and controversial French right to strike.
Friday was spent in rail traffic chaos for many French people after a ticket controller was stabbed 8 times on a train from Lyon to Strasbourg by a man described as mentally unbalanced. Most regions of the country were paralysed by a strike. Though most passengers sympathise with railway workers, who, like bus drivers, have recently been on the receiving end of a rising level of violence in public places, many are perplexed and annoyed that a strike should be seen as the normal and legitimate reaction by fellow employees. I'm very disappointed by French railways, a would-be passenger called Corinne told France Info Radio as she waited and waited for a train at Strasbourg station in eastern France. Talk about public service. The aggression happened at the beginning of the afternoon on Thursday, and there are still no trains and no replacement bus service. We have children to collect from school, but we don't know how long we're going to be stuck here. Maybe we're going to have to spend the night. I think it's scandalous and abject for a public service. French Railways has advised its customers to defer their trips or use their own means of transport. But for many, this is impossible. Some don't own cars. Many were in transit when the surprise strike hit. Jourdain, a Strasbourg student, fits into both categories. I can't take the train, so I think I'm going to have to sleep at a colleague's house, he said. I wasn't able to get to my lessons on Friday. Maybe I'll be able to get home tomorrow. It's been a lot of waiting around. It's a real pain. The real pain in question is caused by something the French call the droit de retrait, literally the right to withdraw. It has become almost systematic for all bus or railway colleagues to strike whenever one of their number is the victim of an aggression. In some cases, the idea is to pressure the local or national authorities to do more to protect them, deploy more police, for example. But in this most recent and dramatic case, it's difficult to see what the authorities could have done to prevent the attack. Guillaume Pepy, French Railways president, though outraged by the aggression, said it could not justify the strike.
L'heure aujourd'hui, elle est à l'émotion.
The present time is one of emotion, for commiseration with the victim and his family, said Pepy. The present time is not, I don't think, right for a strike, which is creating disruption for thousands and thousands of railway users who rely on this public service. For some, though they remain a secretive minority even inside the ruling right-wing UMP party, the words public service have started to grate a little these past years. There is huge pride in France about the state-run French rail network and its superb high-speed trains in particular, and even partial privatisation is seen as a threat to the railways by many. But a unified state monopoly also means a single employer whose deficits are always paid by the government, and it means that when there's a strike, it's usually national. As the poor wounded ticket inspector recovers in a hospital in eastern France, some passengers may remember the announcement earlier this week that, because of EU pressure, France is to turn its Paris-Venice train service over to a private operator, the first time it has ever done such a thing. For a few angry passengers, this might be seen as light at the end of the tunnel. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
We will stay in France, where feminists say the Dominique Strauss-Kahn scandal has forced France to confront long-standing sexist attitudes. And so, buoyed by this new awareness, they're now taking on one of the most entrenched, if not discreet, barriers to gender equality, the word mademoiselle. It's a word that means roughly miss, or Fräulein, if you speak German, that's already sort of on its way out of use among many in the younger generation. But this is France, the country where the ever-zealous Ministry of Culture has say over the public use of language itself. Eleanor Beardsley sends this report from Paris.
In France, when you fill out a form, whether it's a job application or a parking citation, if you're a woman, you have to choose between Madame or Mademoiselle. Too bad if you feel your marital status is nobody's business. There's simply no French equivalent of Ms. Now, French feminists are launching a campaign to change that. Marie-Noëlle Bas, president of the feminist group Watchdog, says the word mademoiselle is no longer relevant.
On old days, women, they went from the domination of their father to the domination of their husband. Then they were mademoiselle when they were girls, and they were madame when they were married. For the men, there is no two states, only monsieur from the youth to the elder.
Mademoiselle, say feminists, separates women into two categories in a manner men aren't subjected to. The corresponding title for males, demoiseau, which roughly translates as virgin squire, went out with the Middle Ages. Feminists say employing the generic madame, like monsieur, will create the same rules for both genders. They also claim leaving out mademoiselle will cut down on opportunities for discrimination and harassment. Bas says France is way behind its neighbors. The Scandinavians no longer delineate between married and unmarried women, and the Germans have dropped Fraulein. The campaigners say even the Spanish have struck señorita from official forms. A new website lets users sign a petition and offers form letters that can be sent to companies and lawmakers to demand that the title mademoiselle be officially discarded. Sitting at an outdoor cafe enjoying an espresso, Talia Breton from the organization Dare Feminism says the climate is right to launch the assault on Mademoiselle.
Il y a une vraie conscience des inégalités entre les femmes et les hommes et une vraie prise de conscience.
People have really woken up about inequalities and sexism since the Dominique Strauss-Kahn affair. And we think these issues will be part of the presidential debate leading up to next May's election.
Though a few sociologists, writers, and philosophers have signed on to the cause, the issue isn't being widely discussed. Judging from first reactions on the street, the feminists have their work cut out for them. 45-year-old Monique Vlaslo is coming out of a shop where she has just completed a form to get a new cell phone. She calls the campaign paranoid.
Pour moi, c'est de la paranoïa. Non, il n'y a pas à être jugé, c'est tout. Bon, madame, mademoiselle.
As long as no one calls me monsieur, I'm fine. Anyway, we naturally refer to an older, unmarried woman as madame. And if you are married but don't look your age, you might get called mademoiselle. It's flattering one way and less so the other. But that's life.
Voilà.
Simone de Beauvoir's seminal feminist work, The Second Sex, was published 60 years ago. Even so, says Marie-Noëlle Bas, French women have integrated the masculine domination of French society into their very souls.
It seems normal to them that the men are more important than them.
And aside from that, says Bas, mademoiselle isn't even a compliment.
Madame for madame, oiselle. Oiselle in French is the feminine of oiseau, and in ancient French that means virgin, that means stupid, that means somebody who needs to be married.
Mademoiselle is only a word, says Bob, but she says it's important to fight sexist words and images because they create the climate of inequality between men and women that can lead to violence. Feminist Breton sums it up this way. If you were to call a man demoiselle, he would laugh in your face. Mademoiselle, she says, is just as ridiculous. Eleanor Beardsley, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
The wine grape harvesting season is underway here in Europe. It's backbreaking work, but at many vineyards it's also an occasion to celebrate heritage and tradition. In Germany's Rheingau wine-growing region, not far from Frankfurt, grapes have been grown since Roman times, and the region is famous in particular for its fine Riesling white wines. Most is produced by around 500 large-scale vineyards which harvest their grapes with machines. But there are also some families who cultivate just a few rows of grapes, just as they have for generations. The Staabs are one of those families. Leah McDonald joined them for their annual harvest to find out how they do things.
Nur ein Schluck, nur ein Schluck, nur ein kleiner Schluck, dann geht's uns wieder gut. Denn der Schluck, denn der Schluck, denn der kleine Schluck, der geht uns gleich ins Blut.
Der Karlstab has many a song praising the Rheingau region's wine-growing tradition. In his repertoire of folk songs is no surprise. As generations of his family before him, he's lived his entire 80 years here, from the fruits of the land, growing grain, vegetables, keeping livestock, and cultivating a Riesling vineyard, the white grapes of which the region is so proud. Now retired, he still keeps a small vineyard out of nostalgia, or perhaps the urge to preserve his heritage by keeping up the region's wine-growing tradition. Family farmers picking grapes by hand together, as they've done for centuries. For this year's wine harvest, the Staab family, joined by friends and neighbors, gather early morning in the vineyard. Karl Staab has trouble walking, so he works his way slowly through the vines, cutting branches of small green grapes from their stems and placing them in a bucket.
Aber ich habe mir Freude bereitet, weil ich schon im Leben das gemacht habe und ich bin noch damit verbunden.
I keep up the vineyard because I've done it all my life, and the vineyard is what I know. It's a part of me, says Staab, who even at his advanced age still finds joy in the hard work. He's clearly instilled his love of the land and tradition in his children. His daughter Margit now works as a translator in the bustling city of Frankfurt nearby, but still looks forward to harvest time.
You know, as a child we did not only the grapes but also potatoes, so I also really enjoyed gathering the potatoes and everything which has to do with the land and with agriculture and gardening. For me it's very important. I couldn't live without it.
Ihr geht zwei Stüppel weiter nach oben. Also hier an den zweiten.
Staab's son Norbert left the Rhine Valley homestead many years ago to travel abroad and currently resides in the German capital, Berlin. watching him at work under the hot sun, amidst the vines, shouting out orders, or in silent concentration filling buckets of grapes at record speed, it seems his heart has never left the region or life on the land. He, like his sister, looks forward to vintage harvest each year.
It's just you keep up the old tradition as it was 20, 30 years ago. I remember that as a kid. And then we used to go for weeks and help with other families. But now it's only this one vineyard, and it's not really considered work.
In the work clothes and cap he's worn all his life, 76-year-old farmer Gerhard Born clips along, keeping pace with the rest of the grape pickers, all the while his bright eyes dancing as he recalls tales of the wine harvest's past in his colorful regional dialect. Today, he still prefers to get his hands dirty picking manually than harvesting the modern way with a machine.
Das ist hier noch traditionell. So ist es immer schon gemacht worden, wie hier.
The way we're doing it here is the traditional way. We have always harvested grapes. But these days, 80 or 90% of the grapes are picked by machine. When you pick by hand, you can sort out the bad grapes, but the machine picks everything, everything. With the machine, leaves get picked and wind up in the wine press, and you can't get them out. I'm not saying hand-picking is better, but even the big wine growers today still pick their high-quality grapes by hand. Okay.
Traditionally, the hardest job in the vineyard is given to the alpha male among the pickers. The job of the Büteträger, which entails combing through the rows of vines with a huge Büte, or vat, strapped to his back. When a picker's bucket is full, he empties it into the vat, which can hold 40 to 50 kilos of grapes. When the vat is full, the Büteträger empties it into a large wheeled vessel by climbing up a small ladder on its side, then bending in half to let the grapes fall in. The traditional wine harvest is an all-day affair with a pause for a simple meal of bread, sausage and wine eaten in the vineyard at noon. Today, most vineyards in the region are owned by large companies, which mostly use machines to pick the grapes. Gerhard Born remembers when most of the wine land was in the hands of small farmers and what the harvest meant to those who toiled the land so hard all year round.
Traubenlese war ein Feiertag. Die Leute haben das ganze Jahr in der Landwirtschaft geholfen.
In my time, the wine harvest was considered a holiday for the folks that had worked hard in the fields the whole year, the whole family, and hired help. First, the grapes were picked, and then there would be a celebration as a thank you for the work. At that time, every single grape was picked, not one wasted, and much more wine was drunk in the vineyards. People didn't have to drive to get home. They didn't have cars. And so we ate and drank till we were a little bit tipsy. Yes, for me, the wine harvest is connected to a little bit of nostalgia. Quite a large bit, actually.
An den Hängen da wachsen die Reben.
Nostalgia for the traditional wine harvest seems to be on the rise in the Rheingau region. A number of broomstick taverns, small restaurants who serve exclusively wine from their own vineyards and regional homemade dishes, are turning the harvest into an annual event. The taverns offer guests the chance to experience a traditional wine harvest for a day. The guests come away with a better understanding of and appreciation for the historical heritage of the Rhine Riesling they enjoy and a few bottles of wine. The event has been such a success across the region, it could just be a new old tradition in the making. With appreciation for the region's wine heritage growing, it's sure Karl Staub and family won't have any trouble putting together an eager troop of grape pickers for next year's harvest.
Dann geht's uns wieder gut.
Liam McDonald, Deutsche Welle Radio in the Rhine Valley.
That is all for this edition of Newslink. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you tune in again on Monday. I'm Matt Herman. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.